Blog Talk Radio.
Yeah? Oh no. Oh no, I don't believe it.
Ba ba bum.
What up? November 19th, 2019, Tuesday night, 7 o'clock on the East Coast. You're listening to a live presentation of the Anthony Experience. I'm your host, coming to you from South Central North Carolina. Tonight's show. It's a interesting show. We're going to get into it in just a second. But I want to talk about the title of the show, because you probably, you know, if you've seen it, you're like, well, what are you talking about? The title of the show is, Why the Hell Are You So so Angry? And that's a question that I would like to ask white people, if you are listening. I have white people in my family. I know white people. I work, you know. If you are listening to this show, and if you think you can answer that question for me, please call in at 563-999-3682, 563-999-3682, because I would like to know, and I think people listening to the show would like to know the answer to that question. And the reason why I ask that question is because, again, this past weekend, Colin Kaepernick showed up to have a tryout, and pretty much white America went nuts. And I got into a couple of back and forth with some people, but now whenever he comes up, I don't say a whole lot because it's pointless. It is pointless because a lot of them believe what they want to believe, even though when you tell them the truth about what he's protesting about, they still don't want to believe what he protested about, even though it's on videotape. And he said it, and it's been taped. But I think a lot of them don't want to listen to it because it's the truth. And for some reason, they hate truth, they hate videotape, and they hate facts. So this went on back and forth, on and on and on and on for the whole weekend. And they're still mad about it. If you have a call, I'm going to go ahead and finish this up, and then I'm going to take the call because I don't like leaving people on hold for a while, and we'll, and the rest of my statement I'll just blend in with the show. But, and also another football-related thing, and then I'll pick up the call. I'm in North Carolina. I grew up on the Dallas Cowboys. And while I'm in Carolina, Panthers came, so I'm a fan of the Panthers. So we have a black quarterback, and Cam Newton, he's been out for a while because he's got a foot injury. So they bring in the backup quarterback, which is a white guy. And for a couple of games, he did pretty good until last weekend. Last weekend, he got his clock cleaned. They end up losing the game. And then my phone keeps reminding me, you know, do I want to see the highlights? Hell no, I don't want to see the highlights. Those are lowlights. They got killed. But up until the Atlanta game, a lot of white fans, and I'm a member of a couple of groups on Facebook, you know, he's the second coming. We don't need Cam anymore. Let's get rid of Cam. Blah, 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 blah. Over and over again, over and over again. Well, this young quarterback got his clock clean, so we don't hear those rants anymore. But a lot of stuff like this is like there's just a lot of angry white guys. And why are y'all so angry? If you've been following football for as long as I have, there was a time when the NFL didn't like scrambling black quarterbacks. Well, there was a time when the NFL didn't like black quarterbacks. And there was also a time when the NFL didn't like black quarterbacks that ran. They wanted the quarterback to stay in the pocket. You know, I remember the days Randall Cunningham would run his ass off. And now we have we've got a young quarterback in Baltimore, and we've got a young quarterback in Houston, both black. And for a while, I think one of them, or there was one black quarterback somewhere that, you know, there was like when the draft was going on, like, you know, whichever team picks him, they were going to not make him a quarterback. They were going to make him a wide receiver. Because for some reason, they don't like black quarterbacks that run. They just want to stay in the pocket and find somebody. When they don't find anybody, you know, usually they're going to either throw the ball out of bounds or incomplete or whatever, or get toe up in the back. So, you know, it seems to me that these same white people that are upset with Colin Kaepernick for doing something that doesn't even, the gesture doesn't even affect them at all, are mad at him now, or probably the same people that when he was playing football, you know, they loved him. Matter of fact, I have to remind some of them that he did take his team to the Super Bowl. They didn't win, but they didn't get blown out either. You know, they went through the playoffs and they, you know, and they ended up in the Super Bowl. So because he wants to protest against racial discrimination and all that, you know, and police brutality, all of a sudden he's the bad guy. And that's all they on and on and on and on and on. I mean, it gets to the point where it just gets to be, you know, it's just a waste of time. And I'm going to get this phone call in just a second, but I'm also sitting here with the TV on, and they're on this impeachment thing. And it seems to me that there are just a whole lot of white angry guys that are just blabbing on and on and on, defending the orange puss bag from the crooked shit that he has done. And I'm thinking, you know, I'm thinking a lot of them know that this guy does not deserve to be president of anything. And they're trying to back him and they're trying to cover for him. And the only reason why I think that they're doing this is because, you know, a lot of people probably think this too, is because of money. I think a lot of these people are mad in this country because once the money is gone and the power is gone, they won't have a whole lot left. I think a lot of them are mad because in about, 20-some years, they're going to be a minority and not a majority. That's why there are limits. That's why there are limits on people coming into this country that are black or brown, because they don't want any more black or brown people in this country, because that will make their numbers go down. But by the way, there are like 400,000 some undocumented immigrants from Europe in the country, but nobody's bothering them. Matter of fact, the First Lady, even though she does soft porn, and she did soft porn, and I ain't got a problem with soft porn, she's an immigrant. Your president has a couple of wives. He cheated on all of them, and a couple of them are immigrants. But why are they so mad? They are mad at everything. Another instance of madness. Before I came on, there's a story about a 16-year-old girl that had plans on shooting up a black church. You know, why are they so angry? You would think that they pretty much stole everything. They make the rules. They have the most money. They have the power. And they're still pissed. So why is that? Why are they so angry? The only people that know are them. And it would be cool if somebody would break down and tell us why they're so mad. They are mad at everything. They were mad for 8 years when there was a black guy in the White House. They couldn't get him on anything, and they tried everything they could think of to impeach this guy. He wasn't wearing the right color suit. They wanted to impeach him on that. He said something about putting mustard or something on a hamburger. They wanted to impeach him on that. They said he was from Kenya when he wasn't. They wanted to impeach him on that. They wanted to impeach him on the pastor of his church. For some bullshit they tried to get him on, come to find out, I played that entire clip on a show a long time ago. They couldn't get him on that. A lot of this other stuff that they claimed that he did, they couldn't get him on that. And they were just pissed And then it was so bad that a group of Republicans called it, I call them teabaggers. And I call them teabaggers because if you want to know what the term teabag means, look it up. And it's not pretty. And that's the reason why I call them teabaggers. They were formed because, according to them, he wanted to run up the national deficit and give everybody free stuff and all this, you know, the more famous thing they're talking about, he had the Obama phone, which is wrong. He didn't start that program. It was started by, I want to say, either Reagan or Bush back in the day. So he didn't even start that program. But according to them, if you're black or brown, and the only thing you want from the government is free stuff. So they're mad about that. So these teabaggers came around, and they called him everything, every name you could think of. Because they said he didn't know what he was doing. He had no idea what he was doing. But he fixed the mess that, that Bush left. And now that you got a white guy back in the White House, because I think that's what a lot of them were mad about, because you know, you have the audacity of having a black guy in the White House. And when you got a white guy back in the White House, where did this teabag group go? They vanished. There are a few still are around, but they're not here anymore, even though the deficit is going up again. It seems to me that the deficits only go up when there's a Republican in the White House. So now the deficit is going back up, and there's nobody out there running around screaming and hollering about the deficit like they used to. So that just goes to show that it wasn't about the deficit in the first place. Because if it was, they'd be out here running around screaming and all this kind of stuff now, but they're not. So it wasn't about the deficit. They are trying to build a wall on the border of Mexico because they claim that only rapists and drugs and all that stuff has been here way before. That border has pretty much been open forever. But there's no border between us and Canada. Why is that? They are only trying to keep brown people out of the country. That's it. That's it. There's no other reason for it. So they're mad about that. What else are they mad about? I mean, I could talk about this for hours, but I'm not because I ain't got the time. And plus, I'm to a time limit, so I can't be, you know, over and over again. But it's just a lot of stuff that they're mad about. And they shouldn't be mad. Trump had everything for the first 2 years he was in office. The Republicans controlled all three sectors of the government. All three. Then he went on a rip and started just putting in judges that ain't got a fucking clue to what they're doing and shouldn't even be running, shouldn't even be doing the jobs they're doing. He's trying to eliminate Obama from the record books by, you know, pretty much reversing everything that Obama did, you know, and he's trying to erase it. So why are y'all so fucking angry? Angry at everybody, except yourselves. But you're angry about everything. Everything else you're pissed off about. So why is that? 563-999-3682. If you got the answer to that question, call. Because I'd like to know. You know. It's like there's something new out there about something, you know, that you're mad about. And I might have thought about it and forgot to mention, but Syracuse University in upstate New York, I actually lived there a long time ago when I was a kid, and I got relatives that still live there. I just saw in the news before it came on that there was some racist graffiti spray. There was a racist messages, you know, on campus. You know, for what? For what? You know, racist people, and I'll say this, and I don't care, you know, people get offended or not. Racist people are stupid. They're fucking brainless. I mean, how can you hate some, how can you hate a group of people that you don't even know? Hate crimes in this country are up. And it seems like they just hate people just because they look different. Well, if you got an issue with that, you should be talking to your ancestors that went to Africa and bought over my ancestors to do the work that your ancestors should have done. But they were too fucking lazy to do it. So they enslaved other people to do their work. But you shouldn't be mad, because they did the job that your ancestors didn't do. They were too fucking lazy to do it themselves. And that kind of ties into next week's show, which is the third annual The Truth About Thanksgiving. And you will hear about that. In case you don't know the real story about that, you will find out next week. Because we're going to talk, we're going to give you the truth about Thanksgiving, and it's jacked up. I'm going to give you the true story, and I'm going to give you the bullshit story. And you probably know the bullshit story, but I'm going to give you the true story. So, every time you turn around, there's always something that's pissing off white folk. And it's just I have no idea. You know, Dave Chappelle said it famously, you know, you can go to Target and get a white supremacist starter kit. They sell khakis, tiki torches, you can get a fucked up haircut and a red hat and start your own chapter of the KKK if you want to. You know, and let me add in there too, also mad at Jewish people. But then you got a president and people of his cabinet that claim they love Jewish people, but there's a sector of them that don't like Jewish people. So which is it? Do you like them or do you don't like them? Because I get that confused. Either you like Jewish people or you don't. I don't get it. And see, and that's what goes back to what I just talked about. Racist people are stupid. And then, not too long ago, Trump had the nerve to go to one of the blackest cities in this country. And he wants help with black people to vote for him again. But you don't like black people. You hardly have any black people working for you. Every time you turn around, you're insulting them. When he was, you know, managing buildings in New York, he discriminated, him and his company discriminated against minorities. But now you run the risk of being impeached, and now you want black people to help you. But then I think today that there was a bill to give money to HBCUs, which, in case you don't know, those are black universities in this country, and they got voted down. But yet and still, it constantly in our face, because you need help. And then you get coons like Owens and Dirt Rock and Polyester to tell us to get off the plantation. So what are you clowns going to do for us if we decide to change up? I don't belong to either party. I'm independent. So why should I join with you guys? You're not going to do anything for me. You don't even like me. You don't even know me, and you don't like me. So why should I join up with what you guys? I shouldn't, and I ain't. But, you know, I like to say that, you know, they are in a perpetual state of madness because it just doesn't seem to end. It keeps going and going and going. Every day you're mad about something. Every day you're mad about something. And I'll go back to the Colin Kaepernick thing. If he does sign with the team, and to this point, if it was me, I wouldn't even go through the motions. I would just say forget. If it was me, you know, I would set up organizations, foundations to help people, to help homeless people, to help hungry people, to help sick people. I would do that instead of wasting time with this other, you know, trying to get back in, because you're not going to trust each other. He's not going to trust you. You're not going to trust them. And then the whole thing this past Saturday was just a whole bunch of stuff. I wouldn't even go. I would just say the hell with it. Do your own thing, because, you know, read these comments now. Is that, you know, if he does go to a team, then all of a sudden the fan base of that whatever team that is are going to stop buying tickets. Well, guess what? Just because you don't buy tickets don't mean that somebody else won't buy tickets. You know, and I had to tell this knucklehead the weekend, you know, I don't want him on my team. Oh, really? You bought a team? I didn't know you bought a team. I thought so-and-so. I thought somebody else had bought the team. So until you put money on the table, you ain't got no team. You're a fan of the team. You might say that, you know, it's yours, but it's not your team. You just follow them. So until you put money on the table, you ain't got nothing to say to nobody. Nothing. Matter of fact, it's funny to me, and it got me, you know, and Facebook, you know, I used to like Facebook. I like Facebook for the fact that I could get in touch with friends and family and, you know, all this kind of stuff. Well, talking about Kaepernick, I posted something that said that, you know, not you, but other people, you know, some people don't have an issue with the president stealing millions of dollars from a foundation that he had claimed he had created to help veterans. But you're upset with a black guy taking a knee because he's protesting racism and police brutality. And that got me banned for 24 hours. So I come up in here, posted that, you know, I speak truth to power, and all of a sudden, you know, the guy that's running the thing, he got mad and put me on, you know, 24-hour read. But then yet and still you let other people get on here and talk shit about the man, but you won't say nothing to them. You won't say something to me because I told it like it was. You know, and it's just like the rest of, you know, just like the rest of these knuckleheads that follow Trump. It's like you only agree with people that agree with you. If somebody comes with something that you don't like, all of a sudden you got an issue with. But we're all not going to agree with each other. Just because I tell you the truth, you're going to get mad. You know, since when does somebody taking a knee affect you in any kind of way? Well, I mean, does it give you heart palpitations? Does it make your cholesterol go up? Does it make your high blood pressure go up? Does it make your sugar go up because he took a knee? Because back in the day, the players, there was a time the players didn't come out on the field. Back in the day, they didn't have a 1,000-foot long flag out there on the field and all that other nonsense. They didn't have that. Back in the day, if I remember correctly, they only sang the national anthem at the Super Bowl. So the players stayed on the field, so there's no telling what they were doing in the locker room until they came out on the field. They could have been eating. They could have been taking a dump. They could have been taking a nap. Nobody knows. So the military gets this bright idea, you know, it's advertising, but it's all it is. players out there, you know, have to stand there for the, you know, there's always some local singing the national anthem, blah, blah, blah. Phony patriotism. And people don't know, but you don't have to stand up for the Pledge of Allegiance. You don't have to stand up for the national anthem. The players in the NFL don't have to stand. And while the national anthem is being played and all that other stuff is going on, there are people in the stadium and standing in line for a beer, standing in line to use the toilet, standing in line for a hot dog. And while people are at home watching the game, they're either in the kitchen cooking or sitting on the couch or in the bathroom or doing other stuff, but they're not standing there with their hand over their heart. So somebody can call and tell me why when Kaepernick take, and other players take knees, that they're mad about that. But I guarantee you if Tom Brady or some other white quarterback did it, they wouldn't have a problem with it. So that phony patriotism, you know, a lot of people are disguising it for racism, which is bullshit. So I call you out on it. So, you know, why are you mad? So let's get to the first clip. I got five of them, as usual. Let's do number one. But let me get that number out again, because I want somebody that, if you're listening and you got an answer, please call in and tell us why you're angry. And if you do call, don't call, don't be with an angry phone call, because I'll chop you off at the legs and then go to the next call. So let's just call and just tell everybody why, if you can answer. Or if not, this will just be a show. Be one of them educational shows where I just do all the talking and do all the listening, which is fine by me. So let's play this first clip. It's short, but we'll play it, and we'll be back.
Why are white men so angry? Seriously, why are white men so angry? You would think that people broke into their houses at midnight, put a gun to their head, and forced them to season some chicken. White men exist in a country where they receive perpetual validation. They run all of the Fortune 500 companies. They are most of our elected officials. They are most of our police officers. Remember that scene in Coming to America where Cleo McDowell discovered that a king was actually a prince and had his own money?
The boy has got his own money!
And if you pull out any cash, you will find a white man's face on it. Like, how can you be angry if every time you look at money in your country, your face is on it? America is basically Wakanda for white men. White men are amplified and celebrated and honored so frequently that it is literally news when that honor is extended to someone who is not a white man. Yet despite all of this, they are our angriest firefighters, our angriest accountants, our angriest hipsters, our angriest presidents. And it's like, yo, why the hell are you all so angry? Every week, it seems like there's a new national instance of white men taking their anger out on innocent people. White male anger looks like Dylann Roof. White male anger looks like a police officer shooting Stephon Clark 20 times while he was unarmed in his backyard. White male anger looks like that happening over and over and over and over and over again, where people who are not white men are forced to deal with this anger and are victims of it. And I guess the question isn't so much why white men are so angry, but what is the end game of this anger? What is their ultimate purpose for stockpiling all these weapons? What is their ultimate reasoning for marching with tiki torches on college towns?
You will not replace us!
We know the answers to these questions, which is why when we're asking why are white men so angry, what we're really asking is there a way to insulate ourselves from this anger? And will the anger of white men eventually kill us all? I'm Damon Young. Thank you for watching. And please subscribe to VSB so we can have enough.
Okay. So that's pretty much where I got the title of the show from. But why are white people, men in particular, so pissed? So angry? So in a perpetual state of madness. You know, and then a lot of them are running around talking about, you know, they want another civil war. Are they mad about that? Are they mad because the side that wanted to keep black people slaves lost? Could be. Could be. Because after they lost the war, there were a lot of laws that were put on the books to discriminate against black people. Jim Crow, the black codes. There was a time after the Civil War, and this led up to the prison industrial complex, that if you were black and you didn't have a job and you were on the street, kind of like if you were on the street hanging out and the cops came up on you and you didn't have a reason to be out there, they could lock you up for being a vagrant. So they could throw you in jail for standing on the street corner, even though you didn't have a job or whatever. So they could, you know, it's stuff like that. You know, they came over, they stole the land, and we'll get more into that next week. We'll talk about the phony holiday of Thanksgiving. And then December, which, you know, there's another phony holiday of December too. But we'll talk about that later. But, you know, they came over, they took the land, they killed the people that were here, they bought their customs and everything else. They bought their radical Christianity over there too, and that's the truth. And we're still having a little bit of that today. And I think it's radical. That's why I don't even go to do the church thing anymore, because I think that organized religion is bullshit. It's radical. It makes you stop thinking, and it's kind of hard for me to understand why the slaves and the slave owners worship the same God. Because you have one group of people worshiping, you know, telling God, oh, please release us. We don't want to be slaves anymore. We want to be free. And then on the other hand, you have people saying, oh, God, please send us more. We need more of these people. Please make them big and strong. We need them. So how can y'all pray to the same God? Nah, I don't do that anymore. So now you got people that so-called religious people that are down with this guy who cheated on all his wives, who lies like a fucking rug. He's broken probably every one of the Ten Commandments, but they still follow him anyway. And it's just straight, it's bullshit. But y'all are still mad. Don't know why you're mad, but you're mad anyway. So this next clip, not a long clip, but it's interesting. And it may give, you know, one of the reasons why that white people are so mad, and you got to listen to what they put it on. There are white people in this country that say that they are discriminated against. Whoa. I'll say that again in case you didn't hear me the first time. There are white people in this country that think that they are being discriminated against. Now, ain't that a rip? Now, you had one group of people that discriminated against another group of people for 400 years. And now, all of a sudden, you are offended and you're being discriminated against. Really? That is the dumbest thing I ever heard of. But they believe that. Some people believe that. Not all of them, but some people believe that. Some people actually believe that. So, if you don't believe me, I'm going to let you listen to it.
We're talking about bullying before, but apparently the latest group who feels bullied are white people. 55% of them say they believe there is discrimination against white people in America. But when asked for specific examples, they couldn't quite say what they thought it was. So what do you think white people are worried about in terms of being discriminated against?
I'm very confused by
it. I'm not asking you.
What are you asking? The white girls.
I'm just wilding in. We happen to have three, so I thought maybe y'all would have some insight.
Well, you know, ever since Lincoln freed all those white people. Oh, no, sorry. I think that they're blaming the fact that maybe they don't have a good income or their life has not treated them well. They're blaming it on discrimination, but it might be about something else. It might be, you know, you haven't had opportunities to go to college, or you're stuck in a rut, or you're working in coal mining where the jobs are going out the window. And so it's easy, I guess, for people to blame something that they can look at or something like that.
The
you
other.
Know? But it's basically being a victim, and victimhood is not helpful. Victimhood only is I'm blaming somebody else for my problem. But this particular thing has nothing to do with being
right.
white. When you walk into a bank, you will get a loan more easily if you are a white guy.
Yeah.
So, and by the way, the entire Congress, practically 100% of it, is white. They are running the country.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
The corporations are run by white men. Television
well,
is run by white guys.
Yeah, that's something I want to ask.
Do
you think that there is?
I don't know.
Well, my question is, do you think if you break it between men and women, that women, white women would say the same thing? I think I think white women could tell you how they were discriminated against.
Mm-hmm. As women, maybe.
As women.
Yeah.
Well,
okay.
Yeah. So I'm wondering if that changes the equation at all.
I think there is one group of people, and we were talking about this in the meeting,
mm-hmm.
that
yeah.
and it's more socioeconomic than race.
Yeah. Yeah.
But
yeah.
there is a group of people that are many white, unemployed people that I think they're tired of being told they have privilege when they're like, I can't feed my family, I
yeah.
can't do anything,
yeah.
which is just mm. a distinction
yeah.
in poverty
yeah.
versus people with money. But the other time is I was trying to really dig deep and play the let me walk in the shoes of these statistics. Have I ever been
yeah.
discriminated against? One time I do feel it, and this is not in comparison to slavery or anything vast, but in my own life, one time the times I do discover it are when I try to chime in intellectually on like a movement, like let's say Black Lives Matter, and
mm-hmm.
I'm saying in this instance, I think the messaging or the strategy of this
mm-hmm.
is not the right move. If I just disagree on the slightest bit or chime in, people are like, you don't understand, you're white, and they excuse you intellectually.
Mm-hmm.
Even though anyone that's white talking about those things can disclaim, I have never walked in these shoes,
mm-hmm.
but I do have a brain and I'm an ally. I want to talk
well,
about
you're
it.
Well, you're more disagreed with and your opinions
yeah.
don't count. It's not quite the same as discrimination.
Well, discrimination is just an unjust treatment based on a difference in race, age, sex. In that situation I'm describing, I am being discriminated. And I'm not saying that
yeah.
I feel the pain every day.
Yeah,
of this.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm just saying I find it frustrating when I'm trying to join a conversation as an ally,
yeah.
and I can't critique anything because I'm white.
But I think Chris Rock said it best. Even though he's a rich black man, the poorest white man would never trade places with Chris Rock. Because being black in America,
yes,
you are the
course.
Most discriminated group in the country.
I am not comparing, just to be clear.
Yeah, no,
yeah,
I'm
no,
just right.
Yeah. I mean, I've never been told
are...
I can't have an apartment because I'm white, for example, or I can't live in this neighborhood
but
because I'm white.
55% is more than half, which I think is much more than I would have expected. I just want to read this end on this quote. Tim Mustick of Maryland said, because you're white, you're automatically thrown into that group as being a bigot and a racist, and that somehow you're perceived yourself as being more superior to everybody else, which is ridiculous. This man is quoted on the record saying
that. I understand that, but now maybe... white folks will understand how we feel when people generalize about us.
Yeah.
Okay. So now, not all, but there are some that seem to think that they are being discriminated against now. What? Really? But I would call that karma. You know, how, you know, when you do mean shit to people, and usually somewhere down the line it comes out and it bites you in the ass when you ain't looking. That's what this sounds like. You know, and all of a sudden, you know, you're used to having everything because you can have it because of the way you look. Now all of a sudden you can't do that, or you can't have that. Now you feel some kind of way. That's just terrible. That's terrible. Now you see how we feel. You know, and you see the stuff that we had to go through, and now all of a sudden, you're offended. Uh-oh, sorry about that. Okay, that was number two, so we got three more to go. So let's pick up the phone and hit the button. Hey, what's going on?
What are you talking about tonight, Anthony?
Oh, you didn't see the headline?
Why the heck are you so angry?
No, it's not heck. It's hell. Why the hell? I'm not saying what I wanted to say. Well, I didn't put it in the thing. I'm asking the question, why are white people so angry? Because they seem to have lost their mind this past weekend when Kaepernick had his tryout. And the whole weekend, I'm dealing with angry white people because they are so upset that he threw a ball for an hour, and he might get picked up for, you know, to be a backup on some team, and they're just so pissed off. And on top of that, I'm sitting here watching the impeachment stuff, and there are angry white people on here. So my question is, I'm just asking a general question, and I'm still waiting for somebody to call, a white person to call. And I'm not saying every white person is upset, but it seems like there's a majority of them upset, and the question is why? Why are they so mad?
Kaepernick, you know, didn't show up at the NFL tryout. He had one down the street or something with himself.
Yeah, he moved it. He moved it, had it taped, had people there to watch him and all that kind of stuff. And I said this earlier. If I was him, I would just leave it alone. I wouldn't even mess with it anymore, because it seems like it's a waste of time. It's just going to be, people already have it in their head what he, you know, the evil stuff that he did, which isn't evil, but they just seem to make it seem like he's just the most, the meanest, the evilest black guy in America right about now. But if it was me, I would just leave it alone. I would just say, screw it. Just screw it. I would just, you know, like I said, I would just go in the communities and help people and just, you know, do that. You know, I would just say, you know, my career is over. I'm going to move on to something else and then just do that. But, you know, I've been in arguments the whole weekend with mostly white guys that are just so bent out of shape that this Negro had the audacity to come back to throw the football around for an hour, wants to come back in, and they are just so bent out of shape about it. And the question is why? And they won't answer that question because they don't even know why they're mad.
You got blacks that's keyed off of him also. And I think he made a bad choice. But he'll pay the consequences.
Well, I think he wanted to do it his way. But, you know, like I said, my thing is I would just be like, screw this. I'll just throw the towel and be like, oh, you know, I'm done with this. I'm not doing it. Because you're going to have – he's not going to trust them, and they're not going to trust him. So it's like, you know, what's the use? Because,
and the,
you know,
NFL, many NFL players have money managers that invest their money in high return investments like private prisons. The same, right alongside of Goldman Sachs, the Fraternal Order of Police, and everybody else. So all that stuff is nothing but a bunch of political noise and so on and so on and so on. things are so interwoven. Look at the Chick-fil-A, I understand, that they're going to stop giving to the Salvation Army because they're getting pressure from the gay and lesbian organizations. Well, I ain't buying from Chick-fil-A no more, even though I didn't. But that's going to hurt poor people because Salvation Army, whenever there is a disaster, whether it's natural or otherwise, they're always there on the scene. The hell, whenever you have a fire in the hood, people get burnt out.
Oh, yeah.
They come there
yeah.
and put folks
yeah.
up, provide them food, clothes, and so. That's hurting
yeah.
people in the inner city, especially blacks.
Well, I think a lot of this stuff, you know, whenever people start putting religion, because a lot of because the thing with Chick-fil-A, you know, I don't eat there. They've got good food, but their stuff is expensive. So if I do go there, it's maybe one
well, you
want to
pay people $15 an hour minimum wage, right?
Well, if they're going to do the job, you know, they got to live. You know, and corporations like that make. They got the money; they can afford it. I mean, they always crying broke. They're not broke.
Well, they.
But I don't.
But
I don't
they have
that.
To. They got shareholders. They have a fiduciary jury duty to return as great as a share. You got people that's dependent on dividends to supplement their retirement, and so on and so on and so on.
Yeah, but the people working there got to earn enough money to live. They got to have somewhere to stay. They got to pay the
rent.
Well, yeah. They got
all that somebody's
got
to pay for. It's going to be passed down to the
customers.
Somebody's
got to pay for it. So mm-hmm. I don't eat there anyway. And the thing with them is, which is to me is, you know, it's dumb. I don't like religion playing and all this other crap anyway. You know, the reason why they're not open on Sunday is because of religion. Fine, that's on you. Do what you want to do. But I've been reading reports on them that they, you know, they were anti-gay. I don't care.
Well,
I don't
think they're anti-gay. They just don't go along with those ideas. I think they respect the people, but they don't accept it. That's the way I do.
But see, the thing is, these same people have money, which is green, and they spend their money. So it's dumb. It doesn't make any sense to me that you're in business, that you're a service, and you want to discriminate against a group of people because you don't like what they do in their private thing. That's their business. If you want to sell something, that means you got to take money from everybody. It doesn't matter what they do on their personal life. It's none of.
Well, I don't think they said that. I don't think they stop people. How do you know?
Oh, because they don't. Well, the thing is,
how do you know somebody is gay?
Well, that's a good question. Nobody needs to know.
Now, I wouldn't have no drag queen reading books in my school library, and I'm not
so
supporting no. I don't want my kids to
what's
be
wrong?
Exposed to it.
What's wrong? If I said little kids, they ain't gonna know. They gonna think whoever's
yes,
doing
they
it.
Yes, they do. I don't want my kids exposed to that.
Nah.
They my
the thing is
but
that they're
see,
reading.
The thing,
wait,
the they thing my
is,
kids.
You got, you, well, take your kids somewhere else.
That's what I'm gonna do.
Here's another thing too.
Well,
see, we're not talking about that, but I'm gonna say about this because you know if you're trying to get kids to read, and that's the main thing, you know, all of a sudden you've got an issue with the people doing the reading. You want the kids to learn how to read. So if I walk up in there in a Barney costume. What's that any different than anybody coming up in there wearing whatever? The thing is,
I don't want that type of individual. Like I don't want my daughter wrestling against a male who all of a sudden say he's a woman. And you know, people do things that's good for their interest. At least they should. I'm no longer going to support businesses that goes against my interest. If they donating to a candidate that's anti-strong immigration, if they anti-Second Amendment, if they anti-terrorist and so forth, I ain't giving no money to them. I don't care if it's an Asian business, a black business, or whatever. That's what people have to do.
Well, let me do this next clip because I'm
gonna hang up and I'm gonna listen to you.
Okay, all right, I appreciate.
Yeah, happy holidays, you and your family.
Okay, same to you.
All right.
Let me look. Okay, let me look at my book and see what I got. Okay, oh, this is, we're still talking about, this is a 60-minute clip, which is fine. But this just gives a little bit more information on what I'm talking about tonight. So let me hit the button.
And thanks to At Home for joining us this hour. Okay, if you drive north from San Francisco, you cross the Golden Gate Bridge, you will soon find yourself on Highway 101, headed into the northern part of Northern California. And if you keep going straight up that highway, about 120 miles up Highway 101 from San Francisco, you get to a place called Ukiah. And 33 years ago, in July 1984, on Highway 101, just outside Ukiah, California, there was an armored truck that was traveling up that highway in broad daylight, and the truck got ambushed. It was a portion of Highway 101 that was on an uphill climb. The armored car was fully loaded, had to slow down as it was chugging up that incline, and that's when the robbers struck. There were other drivers who saw it happen. This was in broad daylight, and they described a pretty professional operation. Two pickup trucks were involved. Once the armored car started to slow down on that uphill climb, one of the pickup trucks pulled in right behind it, and then another pickup truck pulled in right in front of it. So one right behind, one right in front. They're boxing in that armored car as it was laboring up that incline. And then in what appeared to be a well-coordinated action, guys with guns leaned out of the two pickup trucks, one in front of, one behind of the armored car, and they shot out the tires of the armored car. And that forced the armored car to a stop. There were reportedly six gunmen altogether. All of them had their faces covered up with bandanas or ski masks. There's three guys in each of these two pickups. After they brought the armored car to a halt, they then used high-powered guns, maybe rifles of some kind, to shoot out the reinforced glass on the armored vehicle. And that's how they got inside it. They got the doors open, and they took off with 10 to 15 heavy bags full of loot. It was all witnessed by other people on the highway, broad daylight. They drove away up 101 in these two pickup trucks. They dumped them somewhere nearby, and then they got into a different vehicle, and they sped off. It was fast. It was professional. It was a very heavily armed operation. And it turns out they got a huge haul from that one armored car heist, $3.6 million in cash from that one armored car. And some of the money disappeared, was never accounted for again. But when the government filed its indictment the following year against the gang that had pulled off that heist on Highway 101 in Northern California, the government, in its filing, said that they had been able to trace some of the cash that was stolen from that armored car in Ukiah. And the list of where that money went changed everything. $300,000 went to a particularly virulent and violent chapter of the Ku Klux Klan in North Carolina. Another aggressively organizing Klan leader in California got $250,000. The National Alliance, a Nazi group based in Washington, D.C., they got $50,000. The Aryan Nations up in northern Idaho, they got $40,000. That one heist, that Ukiah armored car heist, it wasn't just a huge multi-million dollar robbery. It was also supposed to fund the start of the next civil war in the United States of America. The guys who robbed that armored car on Highway 101 back in 1984, they were part of a neo-Nazi gang that called itself The Order. And The Order is best remembered now for having assassinated this man, a Jewish talk radio host in Denver in 1984, a man named Alan Berg. But most of the crimes committed by The Order weren't just straight murder and assassination, which we remember them for now. Most of their crimes were about money. When they robbed armored cars, and they robbed video stores, and they robbed banks, All of these robberies that they committed, all up and down the West Coast, they were all designed to collect cash to arm and fund a violent movement that was going to wage a race war in America, a race war that would ultimately create a whites-only homeland in the United States. And these guys in this gang, The Order, they weren't the only people who had that idea at the time. A year after The Order was indicted and that whole gang went on trial, it was a married couple in Wyoming. A married couple stormed this elementary school in Cookeville, Wyoming, and the couple took hostages. They had guns and bombs. They took 150 kids and teachers hostage at that elementary school. They held them all hostage for 2.5 hours. They had a ransom demand in exchange for the lives of all of those kids and teachers. The couple demanded a multi-million dollar ransom that they said they would use to finance a white supremacist revolution for a new white separatist homeland in America. In addition to their guns, that couple who took all those kids and teachers hostage, they brought in bombs, as I said, but they were homemade gasoline bombs. Ultimately, a bunch of the kids who they took hostage ended up getting burned. But the only people who died that day were the two hostage takers. Throughout the 1980s into the 1990s, there were regular national white supremacist meetings. They called them the annual Aryan Nations Congresses. Up in northern Idaho. They held a big piece of land up there until things started to fall apart for them, the Aryan Nations, in 1998. A bunch of Aryan Nations security guards were out patrolling while drunk one night. They ended up beating up and shooting at a Native American mom and her son who'd had the misfortune to pass by while the drunk Nazi guards were out patrolling the perimeter of that Aryan Nations land. Ultimately, a lawsuit was brought on behalf of the woman and her son by the Southern Poverty Law Center, and in that legal strategy, they basically came up with a way to bankrupt the Nazis into losing that land up in northern Idaho. The Nazis were forced to vacate, and then the town's fire department got both great practice and great satisfaction out of systematically burning down all the Nazis' buildings one by one after they'd been evicted via bankruptcy. The United States of America, the modern United States of America, has a stubborn problem with neo-Nazism and overt, violent white supremacy. It always seems amazing every time it surfaces, but we have always had it. And over time, they go through various ridiculous and self-important names and iterations and patterns of symbolic behavior. Right? But over time, it's all the same basic idea, and at its core, it's always violent. Right? It's the order, it's the Klan, it's the Aryan Nations, it's the Christian Identity Movement. Now they want to be called the alt-right. Okay, whatever. Their ideas are not new. Their violence is not new. As a country, we have weathered extreme incidents of their violence, even just in the modern era. The Oklahoma City bombing in 1995 killed 168 people, including dozens of kids. Brought down a federal building. Today, a 23-year-old extremist from Oklahoma has been arraigned for trying to blow up a bank in Oklahoma City to try and follow in Timothy McVeigh's footsteps. In 2012, a neo-Nazi covered in swastika tattoos who played in a bunch of white power bands, he stormed into a Sikh temple in Oak Creek, Wisconsin. He shot and killed 6 people in the temple, shot and wounded 4 others. In 2015, another white supremacist shot and killed 9 people, shot and wounded 3 others at a landmark African-American church in Charleston, South Carolina. He said his motive for that shooting is that he was hoping to start a race war. They're all hoping to start a race war. They're always trying to do that. This is a persistent infection in white American culture. And it can be quite fatal. And what I've learned over the course of my 44 years is that this infection in modern American white culture doesn't get better over time. And apparently it never goes away. We are having a particularly bad outbreak of it right now, this year. February, Olathe, Kansas, 2 Indian engineers shot in a bar by a guy who was screaming racial and religious slurs at them. One of the engineers was killed, the other one was wounded, as was a bystander who tried to save them. That was February. Then in March, Midtown Manhattan, a 66-year-old African-American man, literally minding his own business, walking down the street, attacked and stabbed to death at random by a white man with a sword who drove to New York City from Maryland specifically because that's where he thought he could get the most media attention for his plot to kill random black men on the street. That was March. In May, Portland, Oregon, 2 girls on a commuter train subjected to a torrent of racial and religious abuse by a guy who is screaming at them and threatening them. Passersby intervene on behalf of the girls. 2 of them get killed. 1 of them seriously wounded. That happened the same week that this young man, a student at Bowie State University, was stabbed and killed 3 days before he was due to graduate, and just after he had been commissioned as a second lieutenant in the United States Army. The young white student who killed him was a member of hardcore right-wing online groups. That was in May. And now this weekend, Charlottesville, Virginia, a torch-lit neo-Nazi white supremacist march and rally is followed the next morning by a young man who's described as a Nazi sympathizer driving his car at speed into a crowd of counter-protesters, killing one and injuring 19 others. We are experiencing something right now that is not new, but we are having a particularly bad outbreak of it this year. And even if you are cognizant and aware of the long history of this stuff that we've got to contend with as a country, with this problem in American culture and politics, there are, I think, two things that are going on right now in this particular outbreak we are having of violent white supremacism. I think there are two things, despite that long history, being cognizant of that long history and that violent past that we've got, I think we've got two things going on right now that are unusual, that are unprecedented. And that just means it's hard to predict what's going to happen next. Even with all the understanding that we have of how this has proceeded in the past, there are two things about what's going on right now that are different that I think make it hard to understand where this is going this time. One of the things that's different is very practical, and one of them is political. The practical difference is, it's a very, very granular thing, but it may end up being very important. It's the public identifiability of the participants here. You know, robbing a Brinks truck on Highway 101 in California in 1984, those guys wore ski masks, or they wore bandanas over their faces. You know, going to the Aryan Nations Congress in the early 90s up in Hayden Lake in Idaho, that was so far off the grid, those guys felt safe making their homeland up there because in part nobody could find them. Even in white power culture and white power music and gangs, there's always been an element of covert organizing. Right? That's what the hoods are all about. But when these guys all turned up at the University of Virginia on Friday night, yes, it was the Venn diagram overlap between stupid and threatening that they're all standing there in torchlight, right? They're all standing there holding hardware store tiki torches while yelling their Nazi slogans. But however you felt about that emotionally seeing it, those torches also made for some really good lighting in terms of seeing what those guys all look like. And there was, honestly, with cell phone technology now and the way that we cover our social interactions as humans, there was at least one camera there for every single human being who was on site yelling Nazi slogans and carrying a torch. And because of all those recognizable faces, there has been this interesting sidebar of news all day long today where these neo-Nazis and white supremacists and white separatists who showed up on tape and in pictures being at that rally on Virginia on Friday night, there's been this interesting sidebar in the news all day where you see them all losing their jobs today or being denounced by their families or having to explain to their college campuses who they really are and what they really think and what they were doing there. That's a very practical, somewhat small, granular thing, but that will become an ongoing wild card for this movement and for this ongoing violent scourge in the United States that we've faced for so long. Every single person who showed up at that torchlit rally on Friday night will forever be identifiable as a person who went to that rally. It's going to end up being important that they all showed their faces. They were all very well lit. They were all very, very well photographed. Anybody who was just, you know, flirting with white supremacy, because it's the hot new thing in conservative politics in the Trump era, anybody who was just there on a whim, who's finding themselves and wondering if maybe they're a Nazi, they will find for the rest of their life that they are identified as a neo-Nazi or a white supremacist for having been at that event. None of them will ever be able to change that. You think having an embarrassing Facebook feed is going to affect your ability to get jobs after grad school? Right. Imagine what it's going to do to you for the rest of your life if you're well-lit, on-camera, well-defined, identifiable, and named as having been one of these guys punching up counter-protesters while screaming Nazi salutes at the University of Virginia in 2017. And that organizing strategy to do this by torchlight That might have been dumb. It may have also been genius on the part of the organizers to basically lock in lifelong commitment from these guys who were willing to show their faces, to quite literally show their faces at that event on Friday night. For all of those hundreds of guys who were there on Friday night, they are now in it for life. So that's one wild card. That is legitimately new in terms of how these movements have operated in modern history. That's the practical thing. The political thing, the other thing that's new here is, of course, for the first time ever in modern American history, these guys think they have a champion, not just in politics, but in mainstream politics. I mean, yeah, you know, David Duke ran for governor in Louisiana, and there have always been a House member here or there who was willing to associate him or herself with the militia movement or otherwise flirt with the extremes, right? But we have never before had the persistent neo-Nazi and white separatist violent right in this country associate themselves so openly and so lovingly with a serving president. And there's been a lot of talk today and over the weekend about what that association means for this president and how this president talks about that movement. But I think it's also worth looking at what that means, what that connection to a presidency means for these neo-Nazis, what it means for this thing we can't get rid of, for this persistent source of violence and extremism and terrorism in American culture. We've seen that subculture wreak havoc in various ways by various criminal means every decade we have existed as a country. We have never seen one allied with a sitting U.S. president. What does that mean about where that movement goes from here? That's ahead tonight. Stay with us.
Hey there, I'm Chris Hayes from MSNBC. Thanks.
It seems bizarre to have to ask the question, does America have a race problem? All the evidence says yes.
But not everyone in the US agrees. Surveys consistently show that while most black people believe race is an issue, most white people don't. A divergence of opinion that existed even at the height of the civil rights movement in the 1960s. Most white people didn't understand what Martin Luther King was trying to do. So, I'm going on a journey into the mind of white America.
It could be a bumpy ride, according to Talk Radio.
The value in black life given the illegitimacy rate, out of wedlock rate, is far higher than that of the rest of the society. The reason that people have children before they marry is values, not poverty.
Blacks are stupid. That is correct. They are blinded by anger at whites.
You don't need to say white lives matter. Because white people don't walk up to white people, put a gun to their head, and blow them away.
I didn't want to talk to any African Americans for this film. Discrimination is obviously a black issue, but when you think about it, it's mainly a white problem. So I set my own color bar.
Bam, 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 bam. And you know it's coming from those areas. And then the next day, the news will come on, and sure enough, there was a shooting of some young black man.
I'm part of the problem. Because I don't know how to solve the problem, and so what do? I ignore it.
After a while, the race card has been played so much that it has lost its value.
If you think racism doesn't exist, you're white.
Welcome to white, affluent Milwaukee, home to some of the most expensive real estate in America, all groomed lawns and tended yards. But just a few minutes' drive away are pockets of despair. This is Black Milwaukee, home to 70% of African Americans living in the state of Wisconsin. It's poor, run down, undesirable. Professor Mark Levine from the University of Wisconsin gave me a tour and explained how over several decades, mortgage lenders and estate agents steered different races to different parts of the city.
You know, they could sort of deny outright racism by simply saying, well, this is just a hard-boiled economic analysis. We know that African Americans are a greater credit risk and they're not going to, you know, pay back these loans, and so we're not going to make those loans. A study was done about a decade ago by the city to look at exactly that issue, and they found that a white household with income around $25,000 a year had about the same rejection rate for housing loans as a black family with income over $125,000 a year.
And the result of racism in mortgage lending is segregation. And that in turn fuels poverty, poor schools, and so on, as investors turn their backs on black areas, neighborhoods are left to rot. Meanwhile, in white Milwaukee,
people who don't even live in the neighborhood tend to walk through here because it's pleasant on the eyes and it's a comfortable place to be. It's safe. But on the other hand, just up a couple of blocks, I can, especially through the summer, hear gunshots, bam, 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 bam.
So if I was to ask you then, what is your view of those African-Americans living in that area? What would that be based on? Because it's not on personal contact,
right.
Is it?
Honestly, most of it is based on what I see on the news, which unfortunately is a lot of negative.
What I'm saying is I'm part of the problem. Because I don't know how to solve the problem, and so what do? I ignore it.
Do you think a lot of people do that?
Yeah, sure. Well, certainly it's much easier to not know people. If you don't know people, you don't have to accommodate people.
These Americans enjoy a privilege. They can avoid the unpalatable. They live comfortable lives in nice areas because they're white.
And the advantages white people enjoy, the privileges they have, are endless. Academics and educators now believe it's the lack of awareness within the white community of these inbuilt advantages that taints white attitudes to race.
So white privilege is growing up in a society not understanding that not everyone has benefits that are unearned as a result of being in white skin. It may mean that because my name is Martha Berry, people are going to see that as a white name and say, let's get her an interview.
Martha works for a nonprofit organization that helps clients and businesses overcome racial bias.
It would be great to hear what prompted you to come to this class.
Today, she's reviewing the progress made by three former students.
White males actually have a culture. You know, they think white male is the culture, right? There's a story that says fish don't know they swim in water, right?
Yeah.
So white males don't know they live in a white male-dominated culture. And that was the biggest awakening. And once you knew that, then you could understand that there was institutionalized racism.
It forces you to reflect as a white person on what your role is in working to eliminate racism.
You feel that moment of, I am so clueless because I've just assumed that many people have these same opportunities.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And I intellectually knew differently, but you realize for me at that moment how isolated I was in that.
Good morning, Wisconsin. You're listening to News Radio 620 WTMJ. I'm Charlie Fett.
This is one of the most important men in right-wing talk radio in Wisconsin. Charlie Sykes has a legion of listeners, and most are white, suburban, and Republican.
Do you think many of your listeners understand the concept of white privilege? Have they come across that idea?
I think they've heard the term. I don't think they fully grasp it. I'm not sure that I fully grasp it. I actually had a caller the other day who asked me about that, and I asked him to try to define it.
And the caller did a pretty good job.
Well, I've noticed that I have a few of African-American friends. One of my good friends, he's been pulled over at least 15 times, and I have never been pulled over before.
Okay, so you think that is your white privilege? Maybe it's because, I don't know, just the theory here, you don't speed, you don't violate traffic laws, is that possible?
He doesn't do any of those things.
All right.
One of the things that we're seeing in American politics is you have a lot of white, working class, poor people who do not feel that they are privileged because of their race.
So as far as you're concerned, there is no such thing as white privilege. It doesn't exist?
No, there's white privilege. There's all kinds of privilege. There's a reluctance to go back to the racialization of all of these issues. I mean, we do have an African-American president in this country. After a while, the race card has been played so much that it has lost its value.
The election of Barack Obama distorted the debate on discrimination. For many white people, he marked the end of America's conversation on race. For black people, his success actually marked the beginning. And these are some of those for whom the so-called race card has been played out. White, working-class males flocking to Donald Trump.
We won with poorly educated. I love the poorly educated.
Any discussion of white privilege must account for the problems of the poor and working class. But few would argue it's easier to be poor and white in America than poor and black.
White privilege, I just don't see it.
You know what you need?
White privilege glasses. Helps you see the world the way we do.
There's a growing awareness of how corrosive white privilege can be. This video caused a storm online and was produced under the direction of Alice Hunt and her team.
Put those on. Okay, so what do you see then?
I see confusion and disruption in my normal way of looking at the world. And that's what we intended to do with these glasses. We wanted to encourage people to start thinking about what it might be like to be in someone else's shoes.
My journey into the mind of white America has been an eye-opener. I can now better understand how some people can blithely be unaware of the racism around them, be able to push it to one side, push the chaos to the backs of their minds. But is that an excuse for society not doing anything? No.
For a long time, if you went to the library in Wilmington, North Carolina, there was one thing you weren't allowed to research.
We were refused. We were rejected by the librarian.
When I asked about or inquired about 1898, they wanted to know why.
I was told that, yes, they had something, but they kept it under lock and key.
The story of Wilmington in 1898 still isn't widely known.
What happened here on what's now just this empty patch of grass would radically change racial politics in North Carolina.
This is the story of an American election, but also of something we don't usually find in American history. The violent overthrow of a democratically elected government. In the late 1800s, Wilmington, North Carolina was the state's largest city. It had a majority black population, and historians today describe it as a rarity in the post-Civil War American South.
Wilmington, prior to November 1898, was what the New South could be at the cusp of the 20th century.
There was an unusual degree of black prosperity.
In Wilmington, there were successful black entrepreneurs, doctors, teachers, but also black elected officials. And for a time, that was true throughout the state. Take a look at the politicians on this poster of the 1889 North Carolina House of Representatives. Here at the bottom are black Republican representatives, some from Wilmington. North Carolina also sent four black Republicans to the U.S. Congress between 1875 and 1899. The Democratic and Republican parties of 1898 in many ways occupied opposite parts of the political spectrum than they do today.
Most African Americans were voting for the Republican Party, and the Democratic Party was white voters almost exclusively. White supremacy was the central focus of the platform for the Democratic Party.
Republicans in North Carolina were successful in part because of a third party called the Populist Party, made up of mostly white farmers fed up with the tough economic times. North Carolina populists joined up with Republicans to form what they called the Fusion Party. And in the elections of 1894 and 1896, the Fusion Party defeated the Democrats in sweeping victories statewide. That meant North Carolina now had a government that shared power between black and white politicians, including a newly elected Republican governor. Together, they moved towards reforms that would favor black Americans and working class whites.
This was something that the Democratic Party folks were simply not going to accept.
A multiracial government wasn't just a disappointment for Democrats. It was more like a humiliation. They needed a plan to take back control of the state in the next election. So party leaders like Furnifold Simmons, future U.S. Senator, Charles Aycock, future North Carolina governor, and this man, Alfred Moore Waddell, came up with one: to beat the Fusion Party by luring white populist voters away from their alliance with black voters. Wilmington, with a large black population and a local fusion government in power, would be a focus of their campaign. The State Democratic Party Handbook for 1898 laid out their goal: consolidate the white vote by stoking white anger and resentment. It said, "This is a white man's country, and white men must control and govern it." Their most effective tool was the media. One of North Carolina's biggest newspapers was a Democratic Party mouthpiece. It ran racist political cartoons throughout 1898.
Not everybody was literate in 1898, but to see a political cartoon of the type that ran, you may not be able to read it, but you know exactly what it means.
Many of the cartoons were centered on the threat of Negro rule, even though the fusion government was mostly white. They also played up another fear.
Black men threatening white women became a theme. White men need to do all that they can to protect white womanhood.
This was all part of North Carolina Democratic strategy, but it echoed the national racist rhetoric of the time. In one speech that Democrats printed in Wilmington paper, a prominent Georgia writer named Rebecca Felton said,
"If it takes lynching a black man a day to protect white womanhood, I say lynch."
Her speech prompted a Wilmington black man named Alex Manley, owner of the Black Run Daily Record newspaper, to respond with a column. He made a simple observation that, at the time, was shocking.
That white women who had liaisons with black men did so voluntarily and enthusiastically.
Manley wrote, "Every Negro lynched is called a big, burly black brute, when in fact, many were sufficiently attractive for white girls to fall in love with them."
Manley pretty much said, in a nutshell, sometimes white women choose to be with black men.
Manley's editorial became another tool for Democrats. Newspapers reprinted it, called it a horrid slander, and ran comments about it on a daily basis. It was just a few months before the election, and white voters were angry.
By the time the election rolls around on November 8th, black voters, Republican voters, had been thoroughly intimidated here.
By all accounts, the elections of 1898 were a sham. The Democratic Party had a paramilitary group called the Red Shirts. They attacked and blocked black residents from voting. At a rally just before the election, Alfred Moore Waddell provoked the crowds. He said, "Negro office holding ought at once and forever be brought to an end, even if we have to choke the current of the Cape Fear River with carcasses." The votes were counted, and the Democrats won.
Democratic candidates won every seat they had a candidate up for election in.
But some local fusionist politicians remained in power, because their seats hadn't been up for re-election, like the white Republican mayor and the Board of Aldermen. And of course, the election did nothing to undo the economic power black folks held in the city. The Democrats had won the election, but their goal of total white supremacist control remained out of reach.
And so they engineered what was essentially a coup d'etat.
The day after the election, at a gathering for white men in Wilmington, the Democrats unveiled a document called the White Declaration of Independence. It contained an ultimatum. Cynthia Brown, whose descendants were in Wilmington back in 1898, is a historian at her church, where there's a preserved copy of the declaration from the next day's newspaper.
"We will no longer be ruled and will never again be ruled by men of African origin."
They would strip black men of voting rights. They would give white men a large part of the employment heretofore given to black men. And as for Alex Manley, "We demand that he leave the city forever within 24 hours. The next morning, hundreds of white men marched to the offices of the Daily Record. Manley was gone. He had fled to save his own life. They set the Daily Record building on fire. This is where it once stood.
Once the white leadership destroyed Alex Manley's printing press, they destroyed one way in which the African American community in Wilmington could organize itself and keep itself informed.
At City Hall, the mayor and Board of Aldermen were forced out.
There's 200 armed men in City Hall at the time. They didn't do it of their own free will. And as they resigned, a new member selected by the Democratic Party was voted into office.
Waddell, who once threatened to fill the Cape Fear River with black bodies, was the new mayor of Wilmington. Meanwhile, the mob had grown to about 2,000 men, and the violence spilled into the streets. In these photos, X's mark where the first black residents were killed.
The stories are that they were dumped into the river, and there are varying stories about how many people were killed.
I see 40 to 60 clearly as fatalities as a result of the violence, but I think it was higher.
Many black residents hid for days in the swamps and the wooded cemeteries in the city, including Cynthia's great-grandmother. And thousands of other residents fled Wilmington, never to return. Shortly afterward, Democrats printed booklets celebrating a glorious victory, and in the newspapers depicted black residents as the instigators.
This image is a gross misrepresentation of what actually happened during 1898. You know, what you see is African-American men with guns, not white men with machine guns.
The city never regained its black majority population. Jim Crow laws, like literacy tests and poll taxes that prevented black people from voting, were immediately enacted, and Wilmington's spirit of black opportunity was crushed. Black political representation in the state was over. It would be 90 years until North Carolina elected its next black Congress member.
Wilmington did a really great job of covering up a very dark past for a very long time.
Over the years, the textbooks on North Carolina's history have struggled to accurately describe what happened in 1898. This one from 1933 says the situation was unfortunate for both races. And this one from 1978 doesn't have that much more detail. But they both praise Charles Aycock, a politician who helped perpetrate the riot. They say he had a keen mind and a kind heart, and that, in fact, he was one of the best friends that the colored people had in the state. It's a legacy that North Carolina has yet to fully undo. The names of the perpetrators are on Wilmington's school buildings and city parks. But the legacy is also bigger than those names. Turn on the news, and the state's long history of political suppression echoes.
And we turn to a strict new voter ID law in North Carolina. Racial gerrymandering and a push for new voting maps.
The court says the Republican-led legislature redrew congressional districts along racial lines, violating the Constitution.
There's a tremendous amount of intimidation that is still felt by the black community.
It doesn't have to be mass mayhem and violence in the streets.
The strategy shifts towards designing state laws in such a way that you could exclude blacks from voter participation.
The subliminal pursuit of continuing the white Declaration of Independence.
And if you don't see it for what it really is, it can happen all over again.
Okay, so that's the last clip, and I'm running over time, so I'm about to end this, but unfortunately, nobody called to answer the question, so I guess we just got to keep on asking the question until somebody gets the guts to answer it for us. Okay, so that's going to be the end tonight. Next week, I'm going to give you the truth about Thanksgiving. And it's jacked up. If, in case you don't know, you'll find out next week. So join me then for another history lesson in this country's, I don't know. Anyway, that's it. I'm out. I'll see you next week. Peace out.